out there in listener land, a.k.a. Internetica. It's Dave the Clone, mastermind of the Hollow Nine, back again. And here we are with part two of my Dave Maresca experience with Daniel Knopf, chatting for the 20th anniversary of Carnival. And much like when that show was airing, I made you wait an entire week for the continuation and slash conclusion of the conversation. Hope you've been enjoying the ride. I hope you've been checking out some of our other shows too. We've got Feeling It, Healing It, the Diary of Recovery going on the Spotify, or also what used to be our Anchor FM feed, now Spotify for Podcasts feed. And you're probably listening to this on Spotify for Podcasts as well, which is got our main feed. And yeah, it was just kind of one of those things where it was like, oh man, I need some interviews. I need some content coming up here as the weeks are, you know, ticking away and the vault is being emptied and the shelves are starting to go bare. Unfortunately, I hadn't made it to the last two New Jersey Horror Cons for various reasons, being illness and sort of in the middle of moving and all kinds of things going on. So as luck would have it, and as the 20th anniversary of one of the greatest shows ever to be committed to film in any way was approaching, it's sort of like the fates all aligned for me to get a chance to hang out with an old buddy here. So without further ado, here's part two of the Dave Maresca experience with Daniel Knopf, celebrating the 20th anniversary of HBO's Carnival. Again, check the show notes for the part two of the AV Club article that I referenced last time, and enjoy. See what you find out.
So, yeah. I just watched Five Easy Pieces, ooh, which is on Amazon right now. I'd never seen it before. I'd seen the diner scene a million times, but I'd never seen the full movie. And I was just looking at it, and I was going, there's nobody as cool as Jack Nicholson in Five Easy Pieces. And he plays such a complex, sort of tortured character, just trying to find some kind of meaning in life. And it's so ambiguous and beautiful and sort of sad and empty. And it's like, am I a dinosaur? Are people who can like appreciate this stuff? Like, are they all dead now? And you know, now, I mean, but it's like, don't people recognize like how cool this guy is? Don't people recognize how cool like Paul Newman is and Cool Hand Luke? I mean, there's nobody on the screen. They're all fake. They're all really, you know, when they're being cool, it's like, I'm saying my cool line now. It's like, you know?
Yeah, the rest of the time I'm medicated the way everybody else in society has to be medicated, right? Like Cool Hand Luke didn't have access to any kind of medication. He just had to figure shit out.
But on the other hand, I just watched a movie. I had zero. I mean, I was like, let's give this a watch. I've heard it's pretty good. Let's see. I watched Dungeons and Dragons. And it was like, super good, great characters, great dialogue. It's shockingly good, and it's a real movie. You know, I mean, they still do it from time to time. It's sad when it's the, but maybe it's always been the exception to the rule. I mean, good work always is the exception to the rule, and it always has been. It's Theodore Sturgeon, his rule. You know. 95% of everything is shit. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's tough because it's like the machine has just spit so much stuff out that you almost feel like sometimes you don't want to suggest things anymore. You know, you don't want to say, hey, you have 3 hours. Let's watch Heat. You know, let's sit down and just watch a couple guys being cool, or Thief, even better. You know, let's go back to the beginning of just, that's a guy who's just all about his craft, you know, and he's going to go into the adoption agency and tell them to go fuck themselves. You know what I mean? It's like there's so much about a plus too. There's so much sensitivity to like, oh my God, he said that. Oh my God, they're doing this. It's like, yeah, it was a different time. You know what I mean? There was a time before now where things were, people just
like Duel would be impossible if there was cell phones. Like the whole thing, the whole plot would implode. It would never, It would never work now that we have cell phones. You'd just be on the phone saying, this is a guy's license plate. He's trying to run me off the road. Send the cops. You know, that would be the end of the movie.
Yeah. And it's like the human condition got so affected by like little pieces of technology to have what we have now, this whole instantly sharing your thoughts to the world because you were offended. And now the whole world has to jump into that conversation. People used to get offended all the time and just go on with their day. You know what I mean?
Do you edit these things?
I should, I guess. I do. I was going to leave this one pretty raw, but if there's anything that you want me to pull out, I will.
No, we're barely an hour and 10 minutes into this thing. But I want to know if you wanted to ask me more about Carnival, because I'm going off. I'm all over.
Oh, yeah, no, and then I'm kind of jumping in that pool with you. But, yeah, let's see. I mean, I guess there's always the – and I read when you talked to the AV Club about sort of where you were going with the end. I guess for me the big thing was I wanted – because I also hung out with Diane Salinger at a convention last year. And she just randomly broke out into the St. Crispin's Day speech from Henry the Fifth, right?
Yeah, I loved Diane.
I was like, oh, my God, why, I do not deserve this honor at all. Yeah. And she's there dressed as her character from Pee Wee. And I'm like, I really wish you'd just wear the nightgown and sit there catatonic for us for like an hour. And the whole idea that like that she had dialogue going on in her head. In all those scenes between her and Clay where they were speaking to each other silently, there were things that I imagined we were going to see in the further seasons, or maybe we wouldn't because of the time jump, but sort of.
Okay, well, there was a couple things. One was when we cast Diane, I had trouble because there was this genius who was one of the HBO people who was saying, why are we casting an actress in this role? Just get an extra, stick her in the bed. She's catatonic. And I'm going, you don't get it. This is like probably the most challenging role there is on the show because all she's got to work with is her eyes. That's the only thing she's got. And so we did it with an extra and it looked like a mannequin. I mean, it really looked like a wax figure in the bed.
Yeah.
So we got rid of her. We brought in, we cast Diane. And we had a person off stage who was reading Diane's lines, we had a second AD or the script supervisor there was dialogue for Diane in the scripts, so that gave Clea something to react to. Real. So yeah,
that's awesome. And like the whole alluded to history between her and Lodes, you know, there was so much about, I remember watching it the first time going, man, we got to figure out what's up with this bear. Like what happened? What was Lodes's deal before where we catch up with them? And how is that connected? She went catatonic once she gave birth to Sophie. And that's part of this, you know, the mothers go crazy from giving birth to avatars thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some of that where with her being the Omega, so this really was supposed to be the end of the line of the avatars, right? That's part of what the story was, or was there always potential for there to still be?
No, it was prophecy, you know, I mean, you know, the God knows everything. So he knows how it's going to work out. And the end of magic, it's the story of the end of magic. And so he knew that, you know, that this was going to occur. And so there was the usher, you know, and the usher is really the first female avatar, is Sophie, and the only female avatar. And so once she conceives a child by a male avatar, then you have the last avatar, which is their offspring.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. So that was why
that was the, yeah. So when we come back in season three, we'd find, Sophie, and Justin, and they're together, basically living as husband and wife, but Justin's sort of gacked out, you know, in a wheelchair, fucked up. And she has a 4-year-old child, and you don't know whether that child is Justin's or Ben's.
It has to be Ben's, though.
It has to be Ben's. And so The weird thing is it wouldn't have mattered at right. the end of the day.
They're both avatars, yeah.
So that final kiss, that nuclear kiss in the very first episode, if you tilted, we would do that same thing. It'd be the last shot of the show. Actually, I think the last shot of the show would be you'd see that exact same kiss, and then we would just tilt down, and you see they're both holding the hands of a child.
Oh wow!
Between them, so I had to sort it out. I mean, for the last shot of the show is contained in the pilot.
That's amazing. That was supposed to be in the pilot, or is that in the beginning? I think that's
if you see the first reading that she does in the pilot, there's a nuclear kiss.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I thought, and I think it's again in one of Ben's dream sequences, and then
it might be. I might be mistaken on that.
Yeah, I know. I definitely know the scene you're talking about, though. And then I loved one of my favorites was when Ben wakes up or he's in the dream and the nuke goes off and then the dust is settling and Justin's just crouched there kind of looking at
feral.
You know, and he turns looks at, who are you? I mean, Clancy Brown was such a revelation on this show. I mean, and it's funny because when I go back and watch Highlander now and I go, Jesus Christ, the Kurgan turned out to be, you know, one of the stepping stones to the end of the magic for humanity.
I fell in love with him on Bakuru Banzai.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah. Another one that sort of could have used more of an exploration of its universe, you know, like that whole mishmash of character, the types of characters that made up his crew of people.
Now, here's some more trivia. We had a couple guys come in that were in line for Justin. One, I'll give you two that were really interesting. One was Claire Dulles, who played the lead in 2001.
Yeah.
He was a very interesting Justin. We had John Ritter come in and read. Now, John Ritter would have been very interesting, but he like died the next year. So, it's like, oh, well, there goes the show.
Shit.
But another guy who came in and read was, what's his name? Evil Dead.
Oh, Bruce Campbell.
Bruce Campbell came in and read for Brother Justin. And
a little over the top, or
he wasn't right for Brother Justin, but I remember he came into the room and we were reading a lot of Samson's that day, and Bruce walks into the room, just doors open, he walks in, he stops, hold, and he looks around, a whole room is full of little people, right? And he looks around and he goes, what, is this a freak show or what? and there was nobody in that room that found that funny. I was like, oh man, I hope they don't all jump him.
Yeah. Oh my God. And I mean, were they just stunned into silence or
it was like, you
actually just said that out loud.
Who you call it a freak, you know? I mean, God. He was just being a clown. I mean, that's his character. I mean, that's what he's like. You know, it didn't get him the job.
So. Yeah, no, I can imagine. I remember when it was on and I'm watching the first two episodes, and until the darkness starts to come to the surface and you really feel like, okay, this feels a little bit more like, you know, the Kurgan is coming out. We get to see a little bit of the Clancy Brown you expect. I thought for pulling off the innocent side of him, the side before he realizes that
the noble side.
Yeah. When he's still, because that's the thing I thought was excellent about the idea that they're both coming into their own at the same time is, you know, one of them is rejecting it. And the other one thinks he's actually doing the Lord's work, you know, like when he's got that woman vomiting coins in the first episode, he thinks he's teaching her the lesson. And then he says enough and he thinks God is listening to him. It's just like, dude, you know, he is not somebody I would have expected to see playing that part. You know,
he was so powerful. Yeah. He was really amazing. He was so good. And, you know, he wasn't afraid to just go full T-Rex in there when he needed to.
Yeah. And I loved when he was in the asylum at the end, and it was the first time he was really kind of commanding a room full of people to be still from like outside the building and go quiet inside. And I was just like, Jesus, this show. Oh my God, this show. There's never a moment that doesn't give you chills. And even watching it again, knowing it's coming, you're like, oh, I love this part. You know,
one of my favorite times on a set was. When he's sitting in a gymnasium, it's a big empty gymnasium. We have that long tracking shot.
Oh, yeah.
And there's these huge volumetric beams of light coming down, and we go through it, and then we do this sort of a banana move around him and a slight lift on the dolly. And when you come around, you see the room is full of mental patients. And, of course, you know, the way we did that is we had all those extras just following the camera.
Yeah. You
know? And so walking in, getting into place so that when we did the banana and turned around, there they were. It was all good old fashioned, you know, pulling a rabbit out of your hat illusion filmmaking.
Yeah.
And I remember though, before we did the shot, we're sitting there, we're getting everything's like, you're set, you know, okay, do. And then all of a sudden, the first AD, she says, hold the roll. Everybody's going, what? And everybody turns, looks at the first AD, and she's sitting there, and everybody's looking at her, and she's looking at these high windows in the gymnasium. She's looking at them. And then all of a sudden, the clouds part, and those big beams of light come down. Oh. And she goes, go ahead. And then it's like, action. And it's like, you know, God was our DP that day. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow.
But it's just, that's what you get. That's the kind of quality you get is that kind of first AD who's going to recognize, you know, oh, okay, we've got, hold the roll.
Yeah. Because that's a pretty ballsy thing to do, right? I mean, if you.
Not common. No.
Yeah.
Not common.
Awesome. Now, for stuff like that, was that sort of, especially in the first season, were you instrumental or involved in kind of helping with design that? Or is that the kind of thing where they said, hey, we're going to do this. And you're like, okay, you know what I mean?
Well, a lot of it's on the page. So, you know, okay. That's what Scott Winans always said to me. He says, your stuff is so easy to direct because it's all there.
Oh, wow. This was your camera.
Yeah, I don't direct on the page. I don't say long shot, you know, wide, this, that. What I do is I just talk about, you know, what we're seeing, you know, and if somebody's, you know, if their right eye twitches, that means you're going to shoot a close up.
Yeah.
Everybody did their jobs and did a great job. And mostly, you know, when they weren't meeting my expectations, they were exceeding them.
Nice. Wow. Dude, you know, like I think I read in the one article, he said that a lot of it was just such a giant stroke of luck that everything happened the way it did. And it just sounds like, you know, is there anything that you could see down the road for you? Or has there been anything that's even kind of come close for the same type of feeling? Or is there anything
that you've got
percolating that you're sort of hoping to bring together the same kind of a dream team for?
Well, I was thinking, I wonder what my life would have been like if I'd done the full six seasons, you know? Yeah. Because as it was, I was just basically this guy who'd come up with this weirdo show. And people, kind of Hollywood didn't really know what to do with me. And so I continued in the same vein of just, you know, if you go to NOFF.TV, I have the outlines, not outlines, but the decks, some Bibles, and the full pilots for some series that I created. And I've done things since where I go, oh yeah, this is better than Carnival, you know. There was one show called Sleepers. It was
I was going to say, I remember you telling me about this in Long Island.
I was so excited about that, and nobody bit. And you go, hey, I just spent the last 2 years of my life developing this thing. And so, yeah, it's very frustrating. And, you know, meanwhile, you know, I mean, you know, you're seeing stuff on TV that's really awful, and you're kind of going, God, is my stuff worse than that? it's a real mind fuck. But yeah, you know, I mean, I think these things will see they'll see their day in court.
Yeah.
And I, you know, occasionally have somebody comes up to you and it's like oh yeah, we just want you to come in and a getting to know you meeting, you know, meet and greet, as they call it. And yeah. I'll say, so what are you guys looking for? And they'll say, oh, we're looking for blah, 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 and blah. And I'll go, I got one of those. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. And maybe it'll go, you know?
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, you also, I mean, I don't know how, if you got to go, let me know if you're running low on time. I know.
I'm good. Right. I got all the time in the world for Dave Maresca. Are you kidding?
Dude, you know, well, I got to tell you, I mean, I would love to do this every month, you know, just sit down and chat about stuff. Cause it's like, finally, someone on the same level of sanity. You know, it's does feel like
or insanity, maybe.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, common ground at least. You know, you do feel like you're a little bit on a lonely island sometimes with the current state of affairs with things. But tell me a little bit, if you don't mind. I know it's not necessarily carnival, but I think probably, I don't know, I would be remiss if I made this assertion, but I know that right after Carnival, the next project was the Black Box, the... Now, I think I imagine a lot of people came to that expecting another piece of a Carnival type of thing, and it was like its own, almost like what Sleep No More is in New York, right? This kind of theater, depending on where you're...
There's
your
still pieces of it, you know, on the internet. Yeah, it was just for people that don't know, I put two cameras, and we had something like 16 cameras rolling, and we had a 32-hour drama, and we had to reinvent almost everything to make that work, and telling a 32-hour story, you know, in a oneer, you know, and we had to, you know, as far as rehearsing went, we had to sort of reinvent that. We had to reinvent, while the actors had to turn, you know, right, like the process of acting inside out.
Yeah.
And, it was an interesting experiment, you know? You know, we had, a lot of people watching it from all over the world. It was weird.
Yeah.
But I'd love to do that again with a budget, because we only did that with like $70,000, you know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had one contributor, a couple of big contributors, but most of the money came out of my pocket. So I just want to see if I could do it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, because you could do, I mean, the things that could then spring out of something like that, right? I mean, has anything... that you've done since, like, come from ideas that were inspired by some of these other projects? I mean, was that project inspired by anything that happened with learning the business from Carnival, or was that?
No, I mean, generally my process is like this. It's like, I'll just get a notion and I'll go, well, that's interesting. And then I'll put it away, and then it ripens, you know, and at some point it becomes ready to write. But most of them are things that are, you know, people going, oh yeah, you know, what's popular, what's on, what are people watching, you know, I'll do something like that. And what I generally do is it's like, what's not on?
Yeah.
What's not on, and I want to watch it.
Right.
So I'm going to make myself a show now. And, you know, and I always approach all my projects. When I did Dracula, I approached it in that manner. When I did The Astronauts for Nickelodeon, I mean, that was a kid's show.
Mm-hmm.
And I approached it, basically my thing for them was, okay, this is not hijinks in space. It's not five kids get launched into space and hijinks ensue. It's like five kids get launched into space and fucking terror ensues. I mean, what would happen if we launched five children into space? You know, how would the parents be dealing with that? How would the world be dealing with that? How would the children be dealing with that? And there were some real dark passages in that show.
Yeah.
But there were rules, and one of the big rules was there's no such thing as stupid adults in the show. I'm not going to have the kids be smarter than the adults. Right. The adults are just handicapped because they aren't on the ship, so they're not in touch with what's going on, and they're prone to make a mistake in favor of being safe, when in fact being safe is the last thing you want to do in the face of certain threats. So sometimes the children have to defy their parents, but it's their skin in the game. And, you know, it's like, I remember being on the field and having all the parents screaming at me, you know, with when to take a swing, you know.
Right.
That's what these kids are. They're on the field and the parents are all in the stands. And so I was very proud of the work I did on that show. I was proud of my staff. We all just did a great job. And that was another show where everybody just sort of felt like they were doing something special. It's worth watching for an adult, you know, to just check out The Astronauts. And again, you know, it's a show that, you know, it's one season and COVID killed us. So,
So it's like you've got all this magic following you around, and then it sort of gets to like a moment, and then I don't know. It's like, is it the world is conspiring in some ways to try to keep it contained? I don't know, man. There's
please don't say that, or I'll start to believe you. That's a good recipe for being bitter, you know. I don't know. You know, I could have been a contender. You know. I mean, I've had really good luck, and I've had really bad luck. You know. But you know, at the end of the day, what's left behind is my body at work. And it's like I go, okay, this shit will stand up. Like nobody, you know, I mean, even the one episode of Supernatural I did was one of the better episodes that was on that show, you know?
Yeah.
And so I go, everything that I've touched, I've done a great job. Plus, you know, I've been, all the work I've done has been nominated for a lot of awards. And so, I mean, I would love it if somebody would just go, here's $300 million. Go get them. That'd be an extraordinary thing. They're not lining up.
Well, I mean, you know, if once these novels come out, then maybe that's going to be the case where someone says, you know, Carnival deserved a better shot, or at least to get the full story out there. Because, and I think there'll be this kind of thing that would happen where there'll still be so much love for the original two seasons. But if you had the chance to do it again, we won't speculate, because it's going to be, I would say, like a big, huge part of that first opening salvo of that battle is trying to figure out how to cast something like that when you have these existing performances. And to not break hearts out there, because a lot of us, you know, we're always like, you can find everybody, bring everybody back. I mean, especially when I was talking to Diane, I'm like, you would do it again, right? You know, she's like, oh, of course. And she's like, and I don't know if I should tell you this, but Dan did say there's some kind of tie. It was probably when you were going back in to pitch, maybe.
Yeah.
And she's like, they did want to talk to him. And I was like, well, we're all ready. You know, I mean, that was one of the big, you know, Chris Albrecht even admitted once they got so many emails over that one weekend and people, there were petitions. I was in three different websites at the time. It was pre-social media, but it was, there were online petitions to bring it back. Like before too much dust settles, just think about this.
The first season of Carnival, we're coming up on Comic-Con. And I remember calling HBO and going, okay, so what are we doing for Comic-Con? And they said, comic what? Yeah. Like, they had no idea of the fandom world. One point we were having this conversation and they go, we don't understand it. We're not getting the ratings we're hoping for, but there's more people participating in the, you know, in the discussion boards for Carnival than there are in all the boards, other boards combined.
Yeah.
You know? Wow. But we don't know what that means.
Yeah.
And I said, well, it probably means something really good.
Yeah. It means keep it is what it means, because, you know, you bring up again that you brought up X-Files. That was the first show that started the phenomenon of the online message boards and the fan theories, right? You know what I mean? Like, this was, and I think with Carnival, you had such a tightly, obviously, like, we knew you would give us the answers eventually, that we knew that if we saw this thing through to the end, it would all make sense. But until then, all of these questions, you know, and the whole, how does,
well, I mean, some of it is interpretations, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where I knew I was kind of cooking with grease, is when I would read the boards and there'd be people who would be arguing over, okay, what is, you know, we have the pickled punk in the baggage thing, and it opens its eyes, right?
Yeah.
And I would read all these interpretations of it. And one of them was correct, was what I had in mind when I did it. But like, there were maybe 50 that weren't, but they were completely valid. You know, they were totally valid. And I realized, okay, yeah, people aren't having arguments about this over NCIS.
Yeah.
You know, we're actually, this is, people have arguments about this when they're watching, when it's art.
Yeah.
We're making art. We're not making a TV show.
It felt like an important show. It felt like there was something important about understanding what you were seeing. You know, like that diner scene and the every prophet in their house. You know what I mean?
You're
like, wow, like that's a Rockwell painting. But
that was Ron Moore brought that to the party. That was his.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, I really loved his Battlestar Galactica show. That one, you know, I think.
Oh, he's no slouch, Ron Moore. He's really good.
Like, Carnival, I think, is what instilled in me the love of genre TV, you know, of these kinds of, because, you know, Lost came after this. I dove headfirst into Lost, severely disappointed in the ending. And I think that was maybe in some ways we didn't, you know, not that I would ever think, but Carnival was sort of like we set the stage of how to start and then no one had a model of how to end. You know what I mean? They would all say they knew where it was going to go. But like to them, like, oh, yeah, see, it closed with Jack closing his eyes on the beach and he opened his eyes at the beginning. So we knew what we were going to do. I'm like, fuck you. That is not knowing how the show ends. Knowing your final shot and knowing how the show ends are two totally different things.
Yeah.
There haven't been many shows that have even hinted at that they knew where they were driving to.
Well, if you want to know what the most subversive thing I've ever written is,
absolutely,
that's been filmed, you know, that you can watch, it's an episode of The Blacklist, and it was season 2, I think episode 11, called Cape May. The episode is titled Cape May. And I was in the second year. It was no season three. I'm sorry, season three, Cape May. I was in the second year of my contract at that point, so I was almost done with the show. And you know, they gave me an outline that they wanted me to write, and I read it, and I didn't like it, so I just said fuck it. I just wrote whatever I wanted to. Yeah. You know, like, what are they gonna do? Fire me? I'm almost done.
I'm on my way out anyway. Yeah.
And so my bucket of fucks is empty. You know what that is? So I wrote this thing, and James went gaga over it, and our director, EP, you know, director EP went crazy for it. He said, I'm directing this one. Yeah. So and basically what it was a European art house film disguised as an episode of bullshit network television. And if you watch the show, you're going to watch it. You're going to go, what the fuck is going on? And James Spader is such a great actor and he just kills it. And I mean, the casting was great and the way it was shot. And it was like, this is network TV I'd like to make, you know? And it is possible to do like really excellent, like fresh stuff. I mean, I don't know why people just fall back. When I did Dracula, I'd have, I had a, you know, it would be like, okay, no, we're not going to do that because I've seen it a million times and it's completely false anyway. You know, there was somebody who pitched a scene where they hate each other, and then all of a sudden they're in each other's arms and they're like totally making out. And it's like, okay, I mean, I've seen that so many times. I just don't want to see it again. It's so false. It never happens in real life, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I hate those kinds of things that just become these tropes. Mm-hmm. And you go, when has that ever happened ever in the history of like mankind? When have two characters come together in that particular way? Except, you know, somebody did it and was unexpected and it worked in a movie. So everybody dupes it in crappy TV shows.
Or they do it, you know, like David Lynch did it in Twin Peaks with Harry Truman's character and Albert, the other FBI agent that Coop brings in, where they're in each other's face for like several episodes, and then all of a sudden one goes like, "I love you, man," and from then on they're best friends, and we're just like, "Wait a minute, what? Did I just get hit by a truck here? What just happened?" But we buy into it because the rest of the world, you know what I mean, and it's sort of.
Well, see, some of that stuff, though, is predicated. I'm not going to criticize Lynch because as far as I'm concerned, he doesn't make any false moves.
And so
that pipe was probably all laid down. Right. I think at some point you began to realize these characters are really enjoying going at each other's throats.
This
isn't really about going at each other's throats here. This is about the fun in doing it. And at some point they recognize it, you know, and, you know, there's universal things that happen. And I did a version of, you know, talk about gender swaps. I did a version of, I was going to do a television version of Reanimator, with a female Frankenstein. I was trying to think of a moment. I was having a flashback that was like a moment she's having where she's remembering her child has progeria. So the child's dying of old age. And so she's trying to find a way to regenerate cells. And I want to have this moment. And I mean, all of a sudden it's like a moment from my own life popped up, you know? And so nobody knows this moment. Nobody's seen it in a movie, you know? And so I use that moment and it's fresh and it's new and it works. You know, a lot of people who write TV really haven't lived much life. You know, they get in right out of college. And now what do you know when you're 20, you've broken up once, maybe, you've had some really nasty arguments with your mom and dad, you know, whatever it is, it's just a shallow experience, emotional experience pool. And so, you know, there's no depth there. I envy like Charles Bukowski. He didn't break through until he was in his, I think, early 50s.
Yeah.
And that guy he'd lived a life by then. So he had lots to draw on, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. In a strange way, this ties to something that I mentioned in another podcast I'm doing, which is sort of like a chronicling of the hard knock life that Dave's been living for the last couple of years. Some of the things that I've gone through that have really left me in. I mean, I'm in a sort of rebuilding phase, you know, so it's kind of there's a lot of uncertainty out there in the next few steps. But there was something that you said to me when we were hanging out in Long Island about how, you know, a big thing with life is if you just keep walking, like if you know where you want to get to. You have to just keep walking. So if you want to get to LA, let's say, and you're starting in New York and the only way you can get there is to walk, you just keep walking, but you're going to fall. You're going to get knocked off the road. You're going to fall down. You're going to get scraped up. You're going to get mud all over you, but you got to keep getting up and wiping the mud off of you. And, you know, I think at the time I was probably a little young to hear that, you know, it was 10 years ago and I hadn't made any huge, huge mistakes. I'd made a few. But now in the aftermath of some really big mistakes, and trying to not let the darkness get too dark, I've been coming back to that a lot.
Yeah, well, mistakes are your friends. You learn nothing. You will learn nothing from success. The only thing you learn from success are bad things, like how to pat yourself on the back and be smug. That's the shit you learn from success. Yeah. Failure is the great teacher always. And if you're not failing, you're not taking chances. And if you're not taking chances, I got no use for you. You know, nobody has any use for you. You know, you're making safe choices all the time. That's what really bothered me about, you know, in a way, the thing that was so sickening to me about the COVID response was the focus on safety, you know, and it's like, you know, I mean, really, you want to be safe? Why don't you just dig yourself a fucking hole and then just get in it and pull the dirt in after you, you know, rather than locking down and not hugging anybody for 3 years. I mean, it's like safety is like really, really sort of like, overrated, seriously overrated. So if you're going through some tough times, my heart goes out to you. And I hope things work out on the flip side. But look, the fact is things will work out on the flip side. They just might not work out the way you hope they'll work out. They might be better than the way you work out. You might not be able to even, you know, visualize the way they're going to work out, but you just get through it. You get through it and you come out of it and down into the story. And, you know, the narrative, well, it goes, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the beauty of being a writer is you can monetize that shit. Most people just suck it up and it's like bad memories, you know? I mean, you can actually monetize your shit, that terrible shit that happens to you. Yeah. Oh, gosh, my best friend just got killed in a car accident. Well, I'll be able to use that.
And he would want me to. That's the thing.
Yeah, I'm doing this. I'm giving you a tribute to him.
yeah, it's an homage. And it's definitely one of those things that I often say, like, you know, I was really thankful that you gave me a gift in trying to open my eyes to that. I had to go through a little more hell to see the truth in it. But
okay, man. You just, like I said, you point yourself in a direction and you keep walking, you know, figure out, you know, what you want to do. I'm going through a transition right now too. I mean, I'm like sort of in the subtext of what we're saying. It's like, okay, I'm having real problems getting stuff up in town. And I have been, and it's very frustrating. Now we're on strike. So nobody's getting anything up. And it's a chaotic marketplace. And, I'm dealing with people that, you know, it's, seems like they just get dumber every year. I get to wait. It's like I always call it. It's like, you know, I don't want to play Mother May I with Mommy Dearest, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And so that's why I'm thinking, I'll move upstream a bit and start creating IP instead of adapting IP, you know? And do that. But even that's a challenge. But,
sure.
Hey, look, I've got, I can only do like another couple questions. I'm coming up on the,
yeah, sure.
Coming up on, I may just do a go full Biden on you in a second.
We did cover quite a bit of ground. I mean, and I do hope that I lived up to the Dave Maresca expectation of being at least a little bit different. With
I prefer to think of it as the Dave Maresca experience.
Now I need that on a t-shirt, Dan, you know, and it's like, and it'll be a
trick. In those psychedelic, like, font, that psychedelic
font. Yeah. Was there anything I didn't ask you that you were kind of hoping I would, or is there anything that no one has asked you about Carnival that you really want to get out there into the zeitgeist? Because now that we know there's novels on the, potentially on the horizon here, I'm sure a lot of the questions that are hanging about the story, about the characters, that'll all get presented. But as far as just the experience of making the show, or, you know, has 20 years given you any insight about what you might have done differently, or is it affecting the way you're gonna finish it with the novels, you know, things like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was so new and so terrified through the whole kind of experience, and but I did more things right than wrong. The best thing I did is I drive home. I had a long drive home from Santa Clarita to Pasadena. And so on that drive, I always do like this sort of inventory of all of the things, the mistakes I'd made, or the, you know, stupid things I'd done. And then I'd also think about the things I did right. You know, that was a good move. That was good. And the next day, first thing before I got to my office, I'd go to everybody's office. If I owed an apology, I'd say, hey, look, I want to tell you I was out of line, really apologize, and it's not going to happen again. And it wouldn't happen again. And it was a hard process, and but it was also an amazing process. And there were moments on those sets that were some of the best moments of my life. And I'm very proud of the work, you know. I'm hungry to do more, you know. I'm always like, I'm really like, why don't they let me do this show? I know how good this is going to be. I was actually hired by Netflix. No, not Netflix. What I'm saying, I was actually hired by Constantine Films to do a television adaptation of what's that game? You know, it's a video game. It's a horror video game. Starts with an R, I think.
Resident Evil.
Resident Evil. Yeah, ooh. I was hired to do that.
Wow.
And I put together like a fucking Bible that you wouldn't even believe. It was, I knew exactly where I was going. I wrote a pilot that just kicked fucking ass. Okay. And I was so excited about that one because I was thinking, oh, this is a huge piece of IP. Yeah. And I understand you've got to make fans, you got to service the fans. You can't. Right. You know, you've got to service the fans in, and so, but there were enough surprises in it to make it fresh and new. And definitely I thought this will break out as a story. And, everybody who's read that script, goes, oh my fucking God, this would have been great. You know?
Yeah.
But Netflix was the only one that bit when Constantine took it out to market, and they said, yeah, we like it. We like it a lot, but we don't like any of the stuff you've done. any of the stuff you guys have developed, and we're going to develop it ourselves.
Oh, shit.
And then I proceeded to watch that show, and it was like, you just trashed this IP.
Yeah.
It's just,
nobody was happy with that.
Like The Exorcist is another piece of IP that, it's like, oh, I would have loved to have had a crack at that, but they just trashed it. And you go, God, well, you know, these are valuable company assets. What are you doing taking big shits on them? That's become kind of one of the most more frustrating things about today. You know, I don't know what your decision matrix was for deciding on giving this show to this particular person. I don't understand.
It's almost like I always said, and I think it's something that people feel like might be happening now, is when I was in college, I was looking at the people around me. And I'm going, there are too many people whose parents have already built a company who are coming to college for no reason. And they're going to get handed the keys to these, you know, whatever it is, a bread company, an ambulance company, whatever the fuck it is. And they're not going to have any idea how to do what their parents did because they're here on the 7-year program partying their faces off. And it was sort of like the trust fund baby generation, right? Like everybody's got this shit already made. So, I kind of feel like the same thing has been happening in town with you, you know, is that like, you know, these people come out of college and they're someone's nephew or they know somebody, they know the right people. And all of a sudden they're getting like, you know, the guys again, I'll slam them all I want. The Rings of Power guys. It's like, dude, you guys really fucking dropped the ball. You know what I mean? And like,
you had such a great opportunity to do something amazing. Like,
and because of whatever is going on behind the scenes that will never happen.
You can't blame them. They could have been getting, you know, to bring in some really fantastic stuff and getting their ass handed to them by Amazon. I mean, who knows what went down.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, yeah.
Yeah, the Folgers has gotten stale here. You know, like there's something that's not right in the coffee. So,
yeah, well, Dave, a good friend of mine, Dave Thomas, says, yeah, I said, look, I'm not afraid of these people. I have no fear. I go in. If something strikes me as just sort of not a great idea, I just say this isn't a great idea. You know, yeah. I just won't do it. You know, I'll just pretend they didn't say it. It's like the same way I would treat a fart in an elevator. It's just, we all know who did it, but we're not going to say anything.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, your problem is they won't hire you if they don't think you're afraid of them. You've got to pretend to be afraid of them.
Oh my God.
I have to simulate fear to get work.
Dude, that's a script right there. That's the springboard for an entire series of like baking, being afraid of these, you know, that's,
please don't hurt me. I had a guy went on, I did Dracula. I had a producer who called me up. He insisted on a change. I said, it's not going to make any sense to the audience. You know, they won't even know what they're looking at. We haven't laid any pipe for that. And it won't even work as a non sequitur because they don't have a frame of reference for it. And, oh no, well, just, I want you to do it anyway. And I said, I don't think it's a good idea and I don't want to do it. And finally it came down to it. And he was like, I could hear it. It was like spitting pipe. He's British, right?
Yeah.
Listen, just fucking do it. You know? And I said, I'll tell you what, man. If you want to get on an airplane and fly over here and put a gun to the back of my head and threaten to blow my brains all over my MacBook, I'll do it. But otherwise, fuck off.
Nice.
Hung up. This is why nobody lets me play with fun things.
Dude, well, we got to figure out a way to get that. There's got to be a way to get the door to open.
The truth is, I'm not difficult. I'm trying to protect them from themselves. It's like I'm trying to make you people money.
Right.
You know, whatever. Yeah.
Well, every profit in their house, man, and get you back in the house because, you know, Carnival. And I got to thank you so much for even just, you know, hanging out, even back in when we were hanging out in Long Island and hanging out here. You know, it's like very rare do you get to watch something that affects you so much. And then you suddenly, like, I'm not necessarily part of the world, but I get to vacation there a little bit. And at least, you know, I talk to the God of that world every once in a while.
Shut up. Like people say, so I'm going to start checking to see if my wallet's still in my back pocket. And you just reach through the computer and steal my wallet. Oh, look. Well, it's been my pleasure being here. And so you take care.
Yeah, man. You too. Let's.
We'll do this again sometime.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's not wait 10 years to do it.
All right. Oh, hey, by the way, you can cut right there. It's done.
Yeah.
But I'm going to tell you, I'm going to send Oh, you didn't have to do that. I'm going to put you down for a free subscribership to Jinju.
Yeah, man.
I'd really like to hear what you think of that.
Dude.
Because I think it takes some deep dives thematically.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's this sort of like, you know, it's gingerbread people. But there's some shit going on in that story I think you'll really appreciate.
Awesome. Yeah, man. No, so, dude, it's an honor. I would love to. I can't wait to read it. And yeah, man.
And then we can come on and come closer to Christmas. We could talk about it.
Yeah. And I mean,
Dave Maresca's Twisted Christmas Special. All about Gingerland.
I've done a few of those. And there you have it, folks. Wow. I'm really hoping that we can have something like this happen more often. I think it's just such a blast chatting with Dan, you know, very much a kindred spirit there. And I think, you know, just going into these things with the wealth of knowledge on both sides of the table and the ability to kind of throw things around and see where they land, as much as we decried that about the X-Files, I think it's just maybe if I can get some feedback from y'all folks out there,
maybe we can kind of see if Dan would be up for like a, you know, chatting, talking shop with Dan and Dave, some kind of podcast like that, as the season of Spotlight Interviews starts to begin to draw to a close here. In any case, thank you for checking in with us, and I hope you, all you carnies out there, got a little bit more out of this than maybe has been previously floating around. I cannot wait for these novels. I hope they come out. And who knows, maybe we'll see this show rebooted from scratch. It'll be interesting knowing that there are two seasons, the original two seasons, that's still out there and still watchable on Max, formerly HBO Max, formerly HBO On Demand, or anyone who's really into it, who has the DVDs like I do. You know, these things will always exist. And so even if we do get a fresh slate of new people portraying, I wonder if it would be sort of a shot for shot remake of the original two seasons. That would be pretty interesting. HBO, get your balls back and let's do this. So until next time, I'm Dave the Clone saying thank you for checking in. And this has been part two of the Dave Maresca Experience with Daniel Knopf, celebrating the 20th anniversary of Carnival, the loss of which will still go down for me as one of the greatest cinematic war crimes in the history of television. And let's see if we can avoid this from happening again. Let's get this show finished. Let's get the rest of the story out there. And let's get the show rebooted and let's see six seasons of it. I think that would be epic and insane. And who knows? Who knows what'll come next? I hope you're all checking out Dan's Substack and checking out Gingerland. I am definitely diving into that full bore here, and we'll be chatting about it soon. So until next time, check out the other shows going on at the Hollow Knight Network right now: Feeling It, Healing It, The Diary of Recovery, and as always, there's the vast wealth of archived episodes still available on Spotify and on Podomatic, including Sketches of Madness, which is resurfacing. And also, we're on Salzburg FM. I don't know if anybody's been checking out the new radio station launched by my buddy Drew Carson, but we do have content going on over there, so stay tuned in. You never know what's going to pop up. Maybe there'll be some stuff exclusively appearing over there. Who knows? Just like to tease that out there. But thanks for being on the journey with us, and I hope you've been enjoying it. And until next time, adios.
You've been listening to the Hollow Nine Network, bringing you the very best in fan-made media. That's the word hollow, the number 9, INE. Find the Hollow Nine Network on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts. Email us at hollow9podcast@gmail.com. Leave us your feedback. Join in the conversation and be a part of the action. Join in the fun. Hollow Nine.